Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this weekend show, we're going to be talking about some key news releases out of the resource sector and also focusing more broad resource market, trying to get a handle on the correction that we're seeing in some of the resource stocks, the resource prices in general, and just if this is a buying opportunity or how much longer we might need to wait to see a reversal in that recent loss of momentum. Just a reminder, everyone, please go back through our website, podcast, and YouTube channel to listen to all of our daily editorials and company updates. It was another busy week as we still reiterated on some of the key news from this week and brought on a number of companies, a number of them that you have been asking us to bring on. To kick off the show, we are chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, a lot of people like when we talk stocks, so we're going to start off with some of the news that came out over the last few weeks, starting with Bravo Mining. We chatted about Bravo Mining last segment with you at the tail end of May. They had a discovery hole on May 28th that moved the stock higher. It was a new high-grade IOCG discovery, and well, quite frankly, it really kind of changed the story for this company. Since then, June 10th, we had a follow-up one assay release. The company has a large drill program underway, still at this T5 area. Now, Matt, since this discovery hole and this one follow-up hole, the stock has broadly moved sideways, which isn't a bad thing considering most stocks have pulled back over that month period. What's your updated comments on Bravo Mining?
Firstly, it's great to be back on the program here, Corey and Chad. Thanks for having me. Always happy to talk Bravo. And I should lead off, as I did in the last call, by mentioning that I'm highly biased on this name. It's our largest holding by quite a large margin. And as one would imagine, I'm following progress there extremely closely. I think this is a good place to start because we did touch on it in our last call. I believe when we last spoke, it was actually on the day of the announcement of the T5 discovery hole, where they hit a stunning 11.5 meters of 14-odd% copper and a really healthy 3 gram per ton gold kicker, which for IOCG style deposits in the Carajás is a very high, exceptionally high gold grade. I think when we spoke, it was intraday and the share price had risen from 223 where it opened at to roughly $3 per share when we spoke. And by the time the dust had settled and the market had digested the news, we were up closer to $4 per share by the end of that week. And that's where we largely sit today. Since we've spoken, Bravo did come out with its first set of follow-up results at the T5 target. And as a whole, the results were very positive. The 50-meter step out to the east of the discovery hole hit 8.75 meters at 9.5% copper and 2.1 grams per ton gold. This was an excellent result, as the company had already guided that the width of the step out hole or the width of the intercept of the 30 meter step out was narrower than the initial discovery hole, but the grades were the key question. And I think the market, based on core photos as well as the company's description, was maybe expecting copper grades, we'll say in the mid single digit range. So the fact that we were over 10% copper equivalent in the step out hole certainly exceeded my expectations and was an excellent result. We also know that the mineralization now extends at least 50 meters to the west of the discovery hole. We didn't get assays for this 50-meter step out to the west. I presume those will be included in the company's next news release. It does seem that the zone is narrowing in that direction, but remains open. So in terms of looking forward to the coming weeks and months, the company's attention has really shifted at T5 to drilling down dip of the discovery hole. And of course, it's open along strike in both directions as mentioned, but I think they'll probably focus on that at a later date. And these upcoming results from the down dip drilling will be hugely consequential in terms of the scale of what they have at T5. We really have two different possibilities here. The first is that they have a small but high grade deposit, which could be highly lucrative but not valued in the billions of dollars, so to speak. Or in the best case scenario, they have something Salobo-like, which is a close to 2 billion ton deposit, also in the Carajás district, also ISEG style mineralization. That's just an absolute company maker, to say the least. So I would argue that at current share price levels, really either of these outcomes would serve Bravo holders just fine. In terms of a smaller but high grade deposit, it's worth noting that Luis and Simon's previous company, Vanco Minerals, sold their Antas North mine to Oz Minerals, I think this was in 2018, for roughly 400 million Aussie. And this was a relatively small deposit, but because of its location, proximity to surface, a real moneymaker. But ballpark, that was in the range of 5 million tons at 1.5% copper equivalent. So even if Bravo outlines something of this sort, there's very recent precedent of Luis and Simon and most of the rest of the team here, many of which were involved with the Vanco, being able to realize significant value. And in this scenario, Bravo could actually rush T5 into production within a couple years. I know that sounds crazy in the world of mining, where from discovery, it can take 15, 20 years, if ever, to advance a deposit actually into production. But the key here is that Luanga already has been designated strategic minerals project status from the Brazil government. So the project has already been distinguished with this, which was leads to much shorter and streamlined permitting timelines. So I think that's a very key point here in the case that this is a smaller but high grade deposit that's of the size of something that Bravo could realistically develop. Well, less likely at this stage, I think the grand slam potential here is a Salobo-like outcome, which would take the size of the prize into the billions of dollars, unquestionably. Salobo, again, as mentioned, is in the Carajás district, not too far from Luanga. And it's characterized by numerous high-grade pockets of mineralization within a much broader zone of low to medium-grade mineralization. And if we start seeing intercepts at T5, broad intercepts of, say, 0.5% copper, I think this would actually get the market more excited than if we were to see additional very high-grade 10-meter intercepts that we've seen today, because this speaks to the potential scale of the system. So both of these possibilities remain on the table, and we'll get further information here soon as these step-out holes down dip from the discovery hole are completed. And as you mentioned, it's still very early days here. There'll be plenty more to talk about in coming weeks and months, and Bravo, of course, is very cashed up, very well cashed up with a cash position at $29 million US as last reported. So they can go 12, 18 months easy, even at a increased pace of exploration before they have to access capital. And then they've also seen some love at their T16 target, which we can save for another discussion. But they're intersecting narrow and high-grade copper in a style of mineralization that's not been observed previously at Luanga. So I don't think this says that they've intersected the feeder zone per se, but they may be getting warmer. So I know behind the scenes at the company, there's a lot of excitement about that, even though the market at the moment is razor focused on what's going on at T5.
Well, Matt, just a quick follow-up on it. As someone that's been following the stock for a long time like you have, they were initially known at Luanga for the PGMs, the platinum and palladium and the nickel. And so when a discovery like this is made, where a big copper discovery, possibly copper gold, is underway, whether it's the high-grade, smaller deposit scenario or the larger district scale scenario, either one sounds like it's going to be a good option. But how does somebody that's an investor really track? Do you think this is bringing in different types of investor that were in Bravo before? Or do you think that they now have to kind of ignore the nickel and the PGM side of things to focus on the copper because that's where the action is? It's always interesting when a company makes a new discovery when they already have a big deposit defined. So just curious on your outlook and how you think investors are positioning now.
It's fascinating, right? I mean, strategically, and it's a difficult situation for Luis and the management team because there's really three different things going on here. They have the existing deposit, which they're drilling out and pushing forward towards production with a pre-feas expected in the latter half of 2025. So they're doing plenty of infill drilling there, as well as extensive metallurgy, which they've really been doing since day one, which I think differentiates themselves from many juniors out there who in some cases would prefer not to know the metallurgy of their specific project. They're also, of course, pushing forward T5, which is a significant discovery. Scale is still a question, but significant nonetheless. And it's added 200 odd million to Bravo's market cap in just the 4 weeks since it was announced. So that obviously needs to be a focus of theirs, is a focus of theirs, and has attracted a huge number of new eyes to the story who are maybe less interested in a PGM and nickel development play, but love the concept of a high-grade copper deposit or discovery right in the middle of the Carajás. And then the third focus would be exploration more broadly across the land package. I mean, they outlined 17 high-priority EM targets. They whittled that down to 11. T5 was either the first or the second of these that they tested, and boom, major discovery on their hands. So they're not going to give up on the broader exploration thesis either. And Luis and the team have actually guided to the market that they're going to increase their regional exploration and go ahead and test all 17 of these regional targets by the end of this year. So they have three things going on at once. I guess the lucky thing from Bravo's perspective is they have a very healthy working capital position relative to their your average junior. So if they're more capital constrained, they'd have to make some tough decisions on which of these three baskets in which to put their eggs. But at the moment, they're going with an all of the above strategy. Of course, if T5 continues to grow and maybe starts to look something more salobo, we may see resources pulled from elsewhere on the project and focus there. But I think at the time being, they're comfortable advancing each of these three work streams in tandem.
All right. Well, a story that we'll definitely be following up on, because there's going to be a lot of drilling news out of there. Again, we've just had one follow-up hole. Company, as you said, has a lot of money. Still, a big drill program ongoing. It'll be interesting to see how the market reacts to future news. Let's move on to another news release from just this week. Skeena Resources announced a $750 million U.S. finance package for the Eskay Creek project. That was with Orion Resource Partners. Now, this is a lot more money than the number that was in the definitive feasibility study of pre-production capital expenditures being a little over $525 million U.S. Matt, what was your takeaway from one of the largest financing packages we have seen recently in the resource sector?
It was. And I mean, my first thought is I remain ever impressed with Orion. They're really the only full service mining finance group out there that can offer varied financing package of this kind. And I think this deal includes an equity investment, a gold stream, some senior secured debt, as well as a cost overrun facility. And usually with this type of $1 billion financing package, you're talking about herding cats and bringing together 3 to 4 different parties in a complex negotiation, and those can be very difficult to get across the finish line. So I think Orion continues to distinguish itself as a group where it's kind of a one-shot stop if they like the project. Second takeaway, it's been interesting to see a bit of a sell-off on the back of this news. I think Skeena shares initially reacted well in yesterday's trading. But from their intraday high on Tuesday, and we're talking midday Wednesday here, they're down 12 or 13-odd% from that intraday high. So only the sellers really know exactly why they are selling. I guess there's a couple hunches that I would have. One is perhaps, as you mentioned, Corey, there's some folks that were scared away by the size of the package relative to the initial CapEx that was guided by Skeena and their feasibility study. And I think there's also probably a contingent of investors that are concerned, or at least have the perception, that Skeena has now committed to go it alone and build Eskay Creek themselves. So it's likely a good contingent of Skeena shareholders are those that are betting on an M&A outcome here, seeing an advanced mine, not fully permitted to build yet, but presumably getting close, and are looking for a larger party to come in and take out Skeena at a premium to the current share price, rather than Skeena to go it alone and build Eskay Creek. Because look, I mean, it's highly risky for a single asset group to execute on a mine build, and there's just very little margin for error. Of course, on the flip side, it can also be highly lucrative for those groups that attempt the endeavor and then are able to stick the landing. So my hunch is that the sellers yesterday and today, it's probably a combination of surprised by the size of the package and or are taking this to mean that Skeena is going to go it alone. But we're talking pre-show that there's no break fee on this transaction. So I think that's an important point to emphasize, that Skeena is not committed to building this as of yet. They clearly are a step closer to doing so. But if a larger party were to come in, either in the subsequent weeks or, you know, post receipt of final permit, they're not locked in to pushing this forward. So I think that's an important takeaway. It's maybe lost on some of the sellers over the past couple of days.
Yeah, Matt, I think that's a great point. And then also, when we've looked at historically when takeovers have happened, there's a lot of companies that have signaled to the market that they were going to build a mine, only to have that mine scooped up from them by a larger producer saying, hey, before you go ahead and get all the way through this, let us take over. So that's still an option on the table that I think maybe some of the sellers in Skeena haven't considered, is that they still are an M&A candidate. They still need to get that environmental permit. That's one of the last hurdles to cross. But your experience, Matt, when you look at something like a G Mining, where they take it all the way to production at TokenZio, that's one option for a company.
Sure.
Do you think that a lot of companies that are at the development stage right now have to do what Skeena just did and signal to the market that they're going to build it? Because if not, they're just sitting there waiting with their hand out to be taken over. So is this the right tack to take to put together the financing, to show the market the financing package is there, the capital stack, and start moving it forward? Because you're far more likely to get on the radar of a major at that point than you are if you're just waiting and don't have the financing package together.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, only Skeena management knows which direction they're ultimately going to go here. And perhaps it's still an open question within the boardroom. But in terms of increasing leverage in negotiations and competitive pressure, I mean, any company, even those that are desperate to sell, if management's worth their salt, they're at least going to bluff that they have the ability to build the mine themselves. And that can be done by either arranging a financing package, such as what we've seen just here, or hiring the personnel that could presumably go ahead and build the mine. Because it's very rare to have the same group of people that may be experts in developing a mine and pushing it through a feasibility study. The skill set of actually building the damn thing on budget and on time, it's a totally different ballgame. It takes a whole different set of personnel. So there's very few groups out there that have the expertise that are able to do both. So look, even if Skeena's view is that they ultimately want to sell this, this step would make sense. And I guess if they wanted to further indicate to the market that they're willing to go it alone, they could also bring some folks on board in the coming weeks and months that have that mine build experience. And that only increases the credibility of their claims that they're going to go ahead with this.
Hey, just nice to see and very interesting to see a big financing package done. There are a lot of companies out there that would love to get this kind of financing package to move their asset forward. Unfortunately, a lot of these companies are still kind of stuck at that whole financing stage. And if anyone listening wants more information and some insights from management, I interviewed Walter Cole, the executive chairman of Skeena Resources, on Wednesday. That was posted on Wednesday, so I have a listen to that interview. Now, Matt, kind of a negative story out of the resource sector was Victoria Gold announcing a heap leach failure. The stock just got crushed on it. The stocks in the area, in the Yukon, in that Tombstone Gold Belt also got hit on the back of it. Not nearly as bad as Victoria Gold, but now there are some huge questions around what's going to happen with Victoria Gold and that mine. Right now, it is on hold. It's paused. We're all waiting clarity. What was your takeaway and initial reaction to that Victoria Gold news?
Yeah, it's a real shame for the whole industry. I mean, this is the second major heap leach incident that we've had this year, the first being SSR Mining's Çöpler project in Turkey. And it's a real black eye. I mean, I guess my first thought when I saw the news is that I'm relieved that nobody was injured in the incident. Obviously, in the Çöpler incident, that was not the case. So I'm happy that there was no harm done to individuals either working at the project or visiting. Believe it or not, participants in this year's Yukon Mining Alliance tour, which I was fortunate enough to do back in 2019 myself, were literally on site the day before the incident took place. So I'm just very happy that everybody there is safe and sound. And look, I mean, I also feel terribly about the 500 jobs. This was a major employer in this Mayo region. They look very much at risk as a result of this failure. And I mean, the MJG partnership has never been shareholders of Victoria, but I did visit Eagle in the fall of 2019, shortly after their first gold pour. And there's some wonderful people working there. Look, I mean, there's still lots of unknowns about the incident itself. A few that come to mind is, how did it happen? Why did the stock not get halted immediately? It seemed to trade for a few hours post-incident, which struck me as strange. What are the resulting liabilities, and environmental or otherwise? how much will it cost to repair the conveyor and any other equipment that was taken out in the spill, let alone rehabilitate the pad? Or will the pad have to be entirely relocated in a future production scenario? How long will this all take? I mean, there's really more questions than answers at this point. And I do expect there to be plenty of postmortems in the months ahead by multiple regulatory agencies, both provincial and federal. So we'll get more answers, but it might take some time to come out. I mean, going forward for the company and its equity holders, they're in an incredibly tough spot. The Victoria balance sheet was already stretched pre-incident, and it has a 6% royalty encumbrance as well, between royalties held by Osisko Gold Royalties and Franco. So there's no, you know, get out of jail free card there in terms of selling a healthy royalty to raise the capital necessary to clean things up and get the production back into operation. I really don't see a white knight swooping in here and buying the company, at least anytime soon, especially with all the unknowns that I just mentioned, most pressing being the environmental liabilities and the extent of those. I also think it's unlikely that we'll see the lenders in this case. It's a syndicate of lenders, Bank of Montreal, CIBC, National Bank, and Desjardins. I don't see them pushing Victoria into bankruptcy, as they won't want to own this asset, nor do they have the capacity to own this asset. So I guess from an equity standpoint, that's good news. I would argue at this point, the most likely outcome is probably a Gold Mountain Mining type scenario where the company is largely kept on life support, but not going bankrupt, but resulting in extreme dilution to the company in the process. And I guess it's also possible that further down the line, we could see this lending syndicate sell their debt, very likely for pennies on the dollars, to a vulture, whether that's a mining fund or another mining company remains to be seen. But a vulture who actually wants to take ownership of the asset, do the necessary work to clean things up and get the project back in good standing and then put it back into production. But, you know, either way, there's really no quick fixes here that I see. And I don't see this being resolved anytime soon, which is, yeah, really unfortunate, again, going back to the workers involved.
Well, Matt, just to follow up on, I guess, the contagion effect in the Yukon area, because we did see a lot of those stocks get hit pretty hard yesterday in sympathy. Now, some of them have clawed their way back today, but a lot of people looked at Banyan, for example, as the natural suitor being Victoria Gold. And does this interrupt that process now? What does this mean for Banyan? Do they have to find a standalone operation now? Snowline Gold has to get their project built eventually in the Yukon. If there's an environmental contagion, because they're saying that there's possibly a cyanide leak from the heap leach pad into the water supply, into the water table, could that block permitting for a while in the Yukon? Sitka Gold just bought a property from Victoria Gold, and it made sense for their land package, but now that's one less property that Victoria Gold has that they could switch to. So what does this mean for the larger Yukon area, do you think?
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, the Yukon is, this is not Alberta, this is not Saskatchewan. Mining was already under, and it has been under for many decades, under a pretty close microscope. Of course, it's a shame. I visited Armac twice. That's Banyan's project, not far from Victoria. And yeah, it's really a double, some could say a triple whammy there. And in that, one of the obvious potential acquirers is now not going to be in a position to do so. Banyan's also looking at a heap leach operation. So that's, this incident does not help permitting on that front. And then, of course, just the close proximity, we'll have to see how residents and government and the Mayo community react to this and whether it could put a pause on development for the time being. I mean, that's an unanswered question at this point. Look, I mean, Snowline, Yukon is massive. It's hard to get a sense of the scale until you're actually up there. And they're on the complete other side of the province. They're also not looking at a heap leach operation. So one could make the argument that this shouldn't have any effect on them. But by the same token, it certainly doesn't help, and it can affect perception. And of course, Snowline's still pretty early in its growth trajectory here and aren't even getting close to having to worry about permitting at this stage. So I think they're somewhat insulated from that perspective. But we'll just have to see how things shake out for the Yukon more generally. This definitely, even years down the line, could dampen interest in larger groups coming into the Yukon. Which would be a shame for all parties involved here.
Yeah, it really would be, because the Yukon, that Tombstone Gold Belt, it was one of the standout areas over more than just the last few months in this market rebound. Who knows what's going to happen there, but definitely a negative story from this week. Matt, general market comments regarding resource stocks. It was a good run that they had from late February or early March up through either early to late May. And then we've seen a little cooling off, a little bit of momentum loss, the mid-tiers, the majors. They're still generally holding up better, but the exploration plays, man, a lot of those are almost right back to those March lows. Some are even lower than that, ones that didn't get much of a bounce. How are you viewing this market right now where it was a nice run for about 3 months? Now we've had a month of cooling off, and it just seems like a lot of interest and even a lot of good news is being sold into.
Yeah, I sense a lot of frustration out there, particularly amongst junior investors, but even mining investors more generally. I mean, gold has had a very significant price breakout here thus far in 2024. And just judging by the GDX or GDXJ, they've presented no leverage to this move in gold. They're either roughly equal to gold's move or slightly below, depending on the indice that you look at. But by and large, whether they're the big boys or the producers, all the way down to the juniors, they're either barely keeping track with metal prices or failing to do so. I mean, I'm just in the midst of writing the most recent JG investor letter and went back and kind of evaluated our holdings performance so far this year. We're fortunate to have had four positions increase by over 50% year to date. So those have very much carried the portfolio. But if I look at the rest of the portfolio, there's nearly as many names that are down on the year, despite the positive metal price action that we've seen, as those that are up. So this is far from a rising tide lifts all boats scenario. And I think there's some frustration or exasperation out there. Look, if you asked me a few weeks ago, I would have said that we're potentially setting up for a 2016 or 2020 like summer, or where things get very euphoric in the junior space. But I would say now that's looking far less likely to be the case. Perhaps the increase in Canadian capital gains taxes for wealthy individuals has played some part in this, at least in kind of dampening some of the excitement that you mentioned we began to see in late April and into the third week of May. With that said, I'm not advocating the sell in May, go away strategy by any means here either. We've seen significant moves in both gold and copper. Those are real. And I think augur very well for what's to come in the following years. And there is going to be a point here where we do see that euphoria in the junior space, and it's hard to predict when. And it's important for investors not to try to time that perfectly, but ensure that they have exposure to high quality names that are doing good work and aren't in risk of imminent share dilution for when that comes, for them to have exposure, because things can happen very fast in the space, as we know. And look, I know this will be cold comfort for many of the listeners that have junior mining exposure at the moment, but I could really make a strong argument that the fact that we haven't seen euphoric price activity on the back of the gold and copper price breakouts actually augurs well for the duration and the breadth of the move that we're likely to see to come. So I would urge folks to have patience, but look, I'm sympathetic to the frustration that's out there, as year to date, mining stocks generally, and particularly the juniors, have entirely failed to provide any leverage to the price breakouts that we've seen amongst some of these bellwether metals.
Yeah, very good points, Matt. All around, thank you very much for taking time with us. I will post a link to the MJG Capital website in the show notes for this weekend show. Always interesting to hear what you're seeing in these markets. And look, there have been some standout stocks, a bit more than in a true bear market, but you are right. There just hasn't been that major leverage that a lot of these investors are waiting for. Maybe it is just around the corner. It's, again, that wait and see type of mentality. Matt, thank you as always for your time. It's a pleasure chatting with you. Everyone, stick around. We are going to be right back.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.